It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
As you listen to this podcast, imagine that you are joining us at the Ferry Building on the Embarcadero in San Francisco for a conversation entitled Hunger in the Age of Trump. The gathering is hosted by the Food and Environmental Reporting Network and QASA, the Center of Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture. The room is full of Bay Area food fans, media, and activists to consider where we are today in the food movement. And after the panel presentation concludes, and while others are enjoying refreshments next door that you can sometimes hear, I visit with featured panelist Ricardo Salvador of the Union of Concerned Scientists about controversial food issues that go all the way back to the age of George Washington. One of the strongly stated messages is to put up or shut up. We need to either pay more for food or just be quiet and own the fact that we are an exploitive food system. Ricardo, I'm really happy to visit with you because we're following up on a conversation after hearing you make a presentation about kind of the issues related to the age of Trump. And Ricardo, I talked to you almost a year ago, and it's soon after Trump got elected, and you were speculating what might happen to agriculture. A couple questions. I think one is, you were trying to get people to rally around and to express concerns and to wade in on issues. How have they done? If you look at giving a report card to the people that care about the food system, and after Trump was elected and now Trump is in the presidency and they still don't have all the jobs filled at the USDA, what kind of a grade would you give to the food movement in dealing with this Trump administration?
Well, I think that the first job was to realize what had happened and then to begin to observe where the major threats were going to come from. Now, specifically on the Department of Agriculture, we're seeing that there's very little understanding and very little priority given to agriculture and the food system in general. That we could see because the Secretary of Agriculture was the last one actually appointed, and the major positions over there have been very slow in coming. And there's been a realignment that has de-emphasized the importance of rural development in favor of export-oriented all-out production. And that favors a particular kind of farming and a particular kind of farmer. And I mentioned that together with the context that everyone should remember that the farming population is a very diverse population, even though they're relatively small as a proportion of the entire population, you know, roughly 2.1 people farm. Without going into the details of it, you can extract about 1 million of those folks by simply realizing that per USDA statistics, those folks are not trying to make their living from farming. That's not their major income. So that leaves us about 1.1 million farmers. And of those 1.1, about 250,000, 300,000 of them are the ones that produce over two-thirds of the agricultural output of the nation. And those folks are selling $1 million or more. So it leaves us with this group, which is the majority of farmers, about 750 to 800,000 farmers who are trying to make it with agriculture as their main source of income, but are not able to do so. And so they need to supplement with off-farm income, lots of different ways of doing that. But because that is the majority of the farming population, so this was the core constituency that invested their hopes in a disruptive presidency, a new way of looking at governance. And when you look at what the administration has actually done, it has actually threatened some of their major markets. It's actually threatening their labor force. In many ways, it has failed after 1 year to actually begin to deliver, to give any sign that it has any intention to deliver on some of the promises made to that constituency. So because of the numbers involved, the majority of farmers don't look like they're going to be beneficiaries of what this administration is actually doing. And that's an important thing to remember.
You were rallying the troops to express themselves early on. Are you keeping that core together that responded to you, and you had some other leaders of the food movement that joined together, and you were telling people, let's speak up? And so I would imagine you came with a pretty good list of people that have said, oh, I'm in with you, Ricardo. I'm there all the way. Are you able to hold that group together?
Yeah, there are several coalitions that are working on this issue. I'll mention a couple. One is called the HEAL Food Alliance. This is a cross-sectoral alliance that includes representatives from farm labor, production, food chain workers. Key components of the food system whose interests typically are not represented in the nation's food and ag policies. And so this is a coalition that has grown. It's got about 50 members of major organizations, members that are representing communities, that are grassroots organizers, and also large member-based organizations themselves. So, for instance, the National Farm to School Network, the Food Chain Workers Alliance would be examples of members. So there's another coalition, which is called Good Food for All, which, as the name indicates, is predicated on the notion of social justice in the food system. We just had a meeting of this group in D.C. We'll be having another one in the spring, around the time when we expect the Farm Bill is actually going to be on the floor and being debated. After the conference, many of these members actually did Hill visits, visited with their representatives, essentially laid out the importance of many programs that are under threat of elimination or defunding at the moment, that it would actually serve to bring greater equity in the food system. So, yeah, I would say that these groups are activated and very keenly focused on the things that they need to do in order to preserve social justice in the food system.
You know, Ricardo, I heard you speak tonight, and one of the things that I found really surprising and that stuck with me is that when you started talking about the age of Trump, you were saying this has really been some of the history in the United States. I mean, the thing I found shocking by your comment was that you could almost say, kind of like food security and these issues in the age of George Washington. You tended to say that this has been where things have been coming through in the United States. The deck has been stacked against changes. What I heard you say was that Trump is just more transparent. He's not smooth. But a lot of the issues that people are concerned about with Trump have existed for a long time in the United States. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that captures the sentiment quite well. Here's one way of looking at this, and I need to preface it the following way. This is important to remember. Our ancestors did what they did. We are living with the consequences, but it is up to us to create the future that we all want. So what our ancestors did doesn't necessarily need to predetermine that we'll sanction what they did or that we'll continue doing exactly the same things. But go back to that colonial era when the country was established and the original framework for the nation was established. There were very specific beneficiaries of the laws that were put in place during that period of time. So one of the easiest ways to understand that is to look at a timeline of some of the major social innovations that have occurred since that time. So, for instance, it hasn't even been 100 years since women received the franchise. That should be just a very sobering statement. In other words, when the country was established, women were not considered to be full citizens. As a matter of fact, even white men who did not own land were not considered to be full citizens. They couldn't vote. That was not rectified until the majority of the states, concluding with North Carolina in the 1840s, actually had voted to change that aspect of the Constitution. We all need to remember that even though in theory African-American males could vote after emancipation, we are still experiencing rollbacks and systematic voter elimination that is targeted specifically at African-American citizens. We need to remember that it wasn't until the 1940s that Native Americans actually won suits that allowed them to be full citizens and vote. So if you look at that track record, it just tells you that is evidence, prima facie evidence, that the country was not set up for those people. So who does that leave? So the descendants of those early colonists who set up the society for their benefit, who appropriated land, who extracted labor, who suppressed and exploited others, are the beneficiaries without necessarily often being aware of that. And so in order to reform that, we actually need to recognize that that was the source of the inequities that exist in the society today, rather than interpret that you've population of aggrieved, embittered victims, but understand that they're speaking about very real things rooted in the original colonial history of the nation. And it's particularly important because the self-image of many Americans is not that. The self-image is that this is the land of free opportunity and that everybody comes into the world with the same starting line. And in fact, that is far from the truth.
You know, another thing that this reminds me of is that you said that the reason we have hunger in America is we have poverty in America. People aren't eating well and the kids are going to bed hungry because they're poor. And then you use that and you get into a connection about we shouldn't be so proud of the fact that only 8% of our disposable income is spent on food. Could you explain that?
Well, that comes from noticing that that figure has to do with squeezing the supply line. And farm workers and farmers are at the bottom of that supply line. So the purchasing power is further up the line. Farmers have a saying that recognizes the fact that they're not able to determine their prices. In a market economy, that's an extremely ironic feature of an independent producer and seller, telling us that they don't really operate in a market system. Now, there's reasons for this, but the point is that that 8% figure doesn't fully recognize the value that everybody in the system is contributing in order to enable this abundant supply of food that we all take for granted. If we paid for what farmers are actually providing, which is not only the raw products for our food system, but the environmental benefits that some of them actually do worry quite a bit, and then if we expect them to do something about social justice, which means providing worker protections, which means providing benefits, which providing fair housing, fair wages, and so on, we have to recognize that those farmers don't have it in their economy in order to provide all of that. So we need to provide them with the prices that would allow them to do that. And so it keeps on going up through the value chain, and it tells us we either need to be paying more for our food and paying fair wages so that all of us can afford to pay for the right price for food, or else we should just be quiet when it comes to this. We should just own the fact that we're in an exploitative food system, and that's what we want. We can't have it both ways.
When you say that, Ricardo, I was wishing that there were more people in the audience, some of the farmers that you and I both know, that you're recognizing the fact that many of them are inclined to be more generous if they could, but they get such a low price, they barely exist themselves, that it's hard for them to be able to pass it on because we aren't paying enough for food.
Exactly, yeah.
So I guess just in wrapping up, you do a really good job of encouraging people, of drawing attention to the issue. And some people are going to be listening to this and hearing this message for the first time. Where would you suggest they either follow your work or where do they engage and join this movement?
Well, there's two quick and easy ways to follow the work of the Union of Concerned Scientists, not only in food justice, but in sustainable agriculture and in farm and agriculture policy. So one way is just to simply text to this number, and it is 662-266. When you text to that number, you'll engage in this little online dialogue that will get you signed up to one of our lists. The other really quick way is to go to our website. There's a really easy shortcut to that. It's ucsusa.org/food. If you go there, you'll see all of our resources and you'll see our policy priorities. And I would encourage people who want to become members of the Union of Concerned Scientists, what matters most to us is your willingness to work in our issues. We're happy to take financial support when people are able to do that, but it's your membership that values that is the most valuable to us. So,
you know what this makes me think of, Ricardo, as we're just wrapping up here. I was listening to a podcast as I was driving up here to this session and getting a chance to visit with you. The podcast host was saying what his favorite movie of all time was, and it was Chariots of Fire. Huh. And you remember that scene where, you know, the young man wouldn't run because the race was going to be on a Sunday. And so they were all sitting in this room and saying, oh, you need to think about it differently. And then the other athlete walked in and said, another race, another day, or something to that effect, and said that he was going to give up his race so that the guy could run. And he said, yeah, but that's a matter of the committee.
Yeah.
And you remember the answer, what the other guy said in that room?
I don't remember.
We are the committee.
Oh, yeah. And that's a very nice message.
And it's, you know, when you can look at that and you can say, gee, where can I get involved? Is something I really care about? That if you can start looking in the mirror and conversations like this and say, we are the committee.
Yeah.
So, Ricardo Salvador, good luck with all your committees.
Thank you, Roger. Thanks for the work you do as well.
Now, to get an even more direct perspective, here are some of Ricardo Salvador's comments on the panel. This was just recorded from the audience while the panel was speaking, so the sound quality leaves a lot to be desired, but the insights are unique and worthwhile.
The single most important component of the food system is the labor. So imagine the food system without geopositioning satellites providing instructions to self-driving equipment out in the field. That's an entirely possible agricultural system. It's one that existed until very recently. Or a system without biotech innovations. That's a very feasible system. Imagine that same food system without labor. So without that labor force, fruits and vegetables are not picked, cleaned, packed, processed, delivered. No one cleans up after you. Cows are not milked. Meat is not packed. Without that labor, farms don't work, we don't eat. Period. End of sentence. It is the single most important component of the food system, and yet we treat it as an input whose cost is to be minimized. And so I'll stop there because this could go on for a while, but those are the things that need to be reversed. In terms of how to do this, you all are acquainted with the Fight for 15 and many other similar efforts across the country for wage justice. These are critical. There are many suggestions for how to reform immigration policy and labor law, and this does not mean perfecting the exploitation of farm workers, such as the domestic farm worker program would do. There are innovations that we can talk about here. In this state, there's been great progress thinking about this through the program, Blue Card program, that we might talk about a little bit as well. One very important thing that I will mention is that in the Farm Bill, which is currently under discussion in the Congress, essentially what is being discussed there is how to use public resources in order to support a very specific set of farmers in a very specific style of farming. And there is probably no better example of a relic of a system that colonists have established to benefit themselves to the exclusion of those who were imported to provide the labor, both historically during the period of slavery and during this period of immigrant labor for agriculture. There are several programs that are currently being introduced as marker bills to channel in a completely different direction into different styles of farming and different kinds of farmers, those public resources. That kind of equity would do wonders to deal with the situation that I described. Why are people hungry? Because they are poor. And why are people poor? Because they're not able to build wealth. And any of the currently wealthy who have been the beneficiaries of what historians very properly called affirmative action for the white citizens of the country for 250 years, must realize that that same sort of investment, if this country is to measure up to the propaganda about the self-image of the country, needs immediate attention so that it's distributed equitably to all the populations that help to build the country. And the last thing that I'll say, it has been our land, meaning Native Americans who were here first. Their poverty rate is three times the poverty rate of the white population. It was the labor of the enslaved population for almost 300 years that helped to build the economy that allowed the country to industrialize. Their poverty rate is about two times the white poverty rate. Same thing for Hispanic American families. So farming is the whitest occupation in the country. Farm labor and food chain work is the brownest occupation in the country. It's very clear what is happening. When people are hungry, it is because they are poor. People are poor because they don't earn sufficient income. There's a statistic that is often cited as something that this country ought to be proud of, and it is a statistic that, and the way that it is phrased is very important because it is sleight of hand. The statistic is that Americans on average spend 8% of their disposable income on food, meaning that this makes it one of the most affordable food supplies in the world. So remember, this is a shell game, but what I want to say about this specific statistic is that that is not a statistic that we ought to be proud of. It should be a national shame that we're only willing to pay about 8% of our disposable income for food and expect all of the things that we depend of laborers and farmers. Farmers are a very important part of this equation. They don't have it in their economy to do better by laborers because we also don't value what they do. And beyond paying them for the dry matter that they produce, everything else that we expect them to do, say, for environmental benefits and for social justice, we expect them to be altruists about that. We only pay them for one thing, so that's what they optimize. They do the rational thing. And so both of those folks are seen as inputs whose labor, whose skills, whose management are to be minimized. And the way that this can be fixed is in looking at the big picture. I know I keep coming back to that theme. It is not that in agriculture what we're pushing is optimal efficiency so that then we can have the most affordable food supply at the end. We're supporting a wealth transfer and a wealth concentration. One of the wealthiest families in the United States is the Walton family, who's gotten phenomenally rich since their business moved into the food sector. Now, what is happening with this money is that it is being concentrated when a small proportion of the billions that are accumulating this in a family could be applied for fair wages and for the kinds of benefits that all of us expect in our places of work, where this billionaire family would not even feel it. You know, after your first or second billion, the joke goes, you know, what more do you need? So that's the key thing right there. I appreciate the apparent conundrum there, but it isn't that there's not enough money in the system, it's that it's being concentrated, and as we've all emphasized here, it is not accurately reflecting the value of all the different components.
That recording from the audience was not easy to hear. But if you listened closely, you heard Ricardo Salvador, the Union of Concerned Scientists, giving us a lot to think about and a lot to talk about in our own conversations. We appreciate Ricardo's straight talk that a true sustainable food system has to go beyond the environment and include adequate income for farmers, farm workers, and others up and down the food chain. Of course, that may mean that if we spend more money for food, we may have to spend less on other things. But that's a conversation for a different podcast. Maybe The Minimalist.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.